good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, August the 23rd, 2017. 1:13 coming up on 1:14 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You're tuned into the Now program. I am Scott Spears along with you. And today we are remembering one of the greatest comedians of all time, whether it was the MDA Telethon or his hilarious movies like The Nutty Professor and The Bellboy, or teaming up with the legendary Dean Martin as part of the duo Martin and Lewis. Jerry Lewis was an American icon, and sadly he passed away on Sunday at the age of 91. Joining us today is one of my favorite people. She's been on the program countless times. She's an Ohioan, and it's always great to catch up with her, even in not so great times, the passing of Jerry Lewis. It's a pleasure to welcome to these microphones Kay Ballard. Kay, how are you?
Oh, Scott, thank you very much. I wish I could be happier about it, but I'm not. I think about Jerry very often, and he was just a generous, kind, brilliant man. He really was. And if the young people that are interested in comedy rent his movie, The Nutty Professor, they will see how brilliant he really was.
You know, Kay, what do you think made him so great?
Well, he was perfect for the times. You know, he really was. He was never vulgar, never, you know, he just was genuinely funny. And another one that's funny is Jackie Greene. Jackie Greene is brilliant, brilliant also.
We just had Jackie on about a month ago.
Was he on a month ago?
Yeah, he was on a month ago, still doing well, and he's 91 as well.
Oh, he's one. Well, that was a good year for babies.
It must have been. A lot of talent came out of that portal.
Yes, it was, because it was very a different time, and I must say, I think a little better time.
Absolutely. Kay, Jerry Lewis had three stages. He had the Martin and Lewis stage, he had the movie stage, and he had the telethon stage. Why was he able to stay so relevant and so brilliant through...
Because he wanted to be. He just kept working, just as we all do. But he was in a better position, you know. I mean, he was a giant star for a long time. And he just was, I don't know, he was remarkable. I did a movie with him called Which Way to the Front. And I did several of his television shows. And then he was also a philanthropist. I mean, you know, look what, I don't know, they should have found the cure by now with muscular dystrophy. I mean, he really worked for it.
What was it like to work with him? What was he like off camera?
It was a joy to work with him. Because we were the same age, we knew each other from the beginning, and he was a joy to work with. I can only tell you that.
You know, Kay, it's interesting. He was such a funny man, but every time I saw him interviewed, he was also a very serious man.
Well, most comedians are. You know, they just are.
Did you?
I'm very sad in some ways because, well, I don't know. I think I grew up at a better time than the kids today. They think it just comes overnight. It doesn't. You have to go through a lot, really, to know your craft. And that's what he did.
He certainly
did. That's what we all did.
Did you ever have a chance to...
make more money today than we ever made. It's all so bizarre. There's a few good ones today, like Lonnie Anderson. I think he's very funny. But they're in the tradition of the old ones. You know, it's just... it's very sad. I don't know. I'm especially sad because we really did lose an icon and a man who understood comedy.
Without question. Kay, was he... He just was so good. Did you ever have a chance to see Martin and Lewis perform live?
many, many times.
What was that like for somebody who didn't ever see that? What were they? How good were they?
Well, first of all, they had great chemistry, and they respected each other really, and that was a secret. So they were. It's just that Martin wanted to go on to be something else, and he did, successfully. And Jerry went on and did something else very successfully. So, but they were wonderful.
How will you
remember? I can't say enough about him, Scott. Really.
Oh, I understand. How are you going to remember him? How should the world remember Jerry Lewis?
A brilliant, brilliant man. Sometimes he would go over the line, maybe, in comedy, because he did so many pratfalls, he ruined his whole body. He was just brilliant and tasteful, really.
Absolutely. People look at his...
A very generous man. That's all I can say, Scott.
Kay, and how are you doing? We hope you're well.
I'm doing very well, and I'm doing a documentary on my life because it's been a very interesting life.
Well,
I want the kids to know what it is to have to work for what you want. I mean, these kids, they just have it so easy now.
Well, I always tell people one of my favorite songs is the Fast Food Song by Kay Ballard.
Oh, on the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, you can always see McDonald's. But it's, anyway, I love you, Scott, and love Ohio. Very proud to be from Ohio. And I just can only say that one of the great ones are gone.
Absolutely. I love talking
and
to
after
you.
After Shecky, I think there will be no more.
Well, we've still got UK.
Oh, well, thank you, at the moment, anyway.
Hopefully for many more moments. It's always
I'm really very proud of the documentary because wonderful people appeared. Hal Prince and Woody Allen and a lot of wonderful people.
Do we know when this will be out?
Well, it's been going for a year, so I certainly hope they hurry up.
we will.
I'd like to see it before I leave the earth. So anyway,
I
think it'll be out soon.
Good. And when it comes out,
anyway, I love you, Scott.
I love you, Kay. You stay well, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Kay
Ballard, one of a kind. We're going to change gears here really quick. Take a break and come back with much more right after this. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, the voices that you want to hear. Marianne Michaels reading a poem by Nan Britton, the mother of the daughter of President Warren G. Harding.
And it's called Her Eyes by Nan Britton. Sometimes her eyes are blue as deep sea blue, and calm as water stilted at evenfall. I see not quite my child in these blue eyes, but him whose soul shines wondrously through her. Serene and unafraid he was, and knew how to dispel the fears in other hearts. Meeting an anxious gaze, all tranquility. These are her father's eyes. Sometimes her eyes are blue, the azure blue of an October sky on mountaintops. I do not see my child in these blue eyes. They are the eyes of him whose spirit glowed with happiness of soul alone, which lies far deeper than the depths of bluest eyes, whose smile a thing of joy it was to see. These eyes, this smile, are his. Sometimes her eyes are of a tired gray blue, filled with the sadness of an age-old world. And then again, my child's not in these eyes, the one whom grief assailed, whom disappointment with its great weight. Around his head a halo memory casts, reflecting that refiner's fire which purged him clean and made him what he was. Sometimes, in child amaze and wonder blue, her baby eyes are lifted up to mine. These only are the eyes she brought with her. And so I fold her close within my arms and talk of dolls and stars and mother love. For well I know that pitifully soon she will be grown, and then her eyes will hold only the deeper lights his own eyes knew.
Ah, you ought to get a job reading books, Marianne. That was very good.
That's great.
Thank you.
That is the introduction to The President's Daughter.
WWGA Radio 107.1 FM, the voices you want to hear. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
Scott Spears back with you here on this Wednesday, August the 23rd, 2017, 24 minutes past the hour, and lots going on in the world in the last 24 hours. President Trump gave a very interesting speech last night. I watched the whole thing on CNN, and I can confirm that CNN did not cut away from it at any point. Watched it on CNN. I think he said they cut the lights at one point, but they didn't. And this morning, we heard some audio excerpts on Morning Joe from Hillary Clinton's new book, What Happened, which will be on bookshelves and stands and nooks and all those things on September 12th, I believe, is the release date right after Labor Day. Joining us to help sort all this out, all these interesting things going on, one of my favorite people, former panelist on the McLaughlin Group and possibly future, and writer for the Daily Beast, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm trying to keep up with everything that's happening, just like you and the rest of the world. You know, the everything this president does gets covered. That's interesting that you pointed out that C-SPAN covered the rally in its entirety. I think the cable networks were trying to show some discipline that, you know, every word he says and every criticism he levies does not necessarily warrant the breaking news live coverage. So they were only showing parts of what he said. No, that's correct. But C-SPAN did stick through the whole thing.
Well, and I wanted to point out, because if people were not watching CNN last night, here's the take from it. President Trump did say at times, because I think the only one he mentioned by name in that, he mentioned New York Times, Washington Post, he mentioned Fox News as being good, but the only one he really trashed was CNN. And they never cut away. They never cut away. And they kept saying that they won't show the crowds. They showed the crowds.
Right.
So
right.
What was that all about? Do you think he just watches CNN all the time?
You know, I think he's discovered that CNN is kind of the code word for all mainstream liberal, which he has castigated as, you know, liberal and opposed to him. And I think it's just it's a great attack line for the people who are in that arena. It was pointed out this morning that the arena was half filled, so they didn't fill it to the rafters. And, you know, the crowd was described as older, dominantly white, you know, sort of the classic Trump supporter. That's not America in its entirety. This is the hardcore Republican base, and he really needs them to stick by him because it's about all he has. His poll ratings are in the, you know, low to mid 30s overall, and I would estimate that the real people who he can't lose no matter what he does is probably about 25% population. That's not insignificant, but the fact that he's now going after his Republican colleagues, I mean, this is the party that he leads. He's going after the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, and then in the home state of two Republican senators, Jeff Flake and John McCain. He didn't mention their name. Now, they weren't going to show up at this rally regardless, and both of them have been pretty critical of him. But he's actively supporting a primary challenge to Jeff Flake. And it's been pointed out that he really needs to keep that Republican majority in the Senate. It's a pretty narrow majority, 52, if he wants to avoid a bad outcome should impeachment proceedings get underway. So he's not helping himself long term in his party by trashing other Republican senators because they don't agree with him or this or that policy, and then going after McConnell in this phone call that's been reported through people who McConnell apparently briefed after the call. He basically assailed McConnell for not being able to rein in the Senate Russia investigation, and legally, he could have opened up another front in the obstruction of justice case that's building against him. I mean, that's not how you behave in government when you're being investigated. You don't go after the people in charge. So he's just blundering about, and well, the rest of us kind of watch with our mouths open, and we shouldn't be surprised at this point, I guess. But it really always feels like this is going to have to come to some sort of end of some sort, and what that end is, I don't begin to know.
Before I get into some of the things that he talked about, here was my, like I say, I watched it beginning to end. It was a long speech. I think it went over an hour. They never cut away from it. But here's my question. I wasn't surprised by anything, but what was that? What was that supposed to be about? What was the point? I thought, why didn't he just stay at the White House and work on some legislation? What was the point of that?
Because he's most comfortable in this campaign mode. So good for you. I mean, given the time difference, by the time I stopped watching, MSNBC just had a little screen in the bottom of the page with, I guess it was the introductory speakers. So I wasn't even aware whether they just went with it fully or not. I thought they were trying to show some restraint to show that we, you know, the mainstream media is capable of covering and doing something other than Trump news all the time. This is about, again, it's about stoking the base. It's about fulfilling his psychological need to be in front of a crowd that affirms and reaffirms him over and over. It's about venting, getting rid of the frustration and how he thinks the media has miscovered him over the Charlottesville clashes, that he did say he was critical and that's not the part they covered. And I think it's the area that he's comfortable in. And he can't get over the fact that he actually won the election. And so he wants to replay 2016. And that rally could have been held in the heyday of the primaries last year. He didn't say anything about his newly unveiled Afghan policy. He didn't say anything about the tax reform legislation that supposedly his aides are working on. There was really no legislative meat here, except if you count his frustration at not having gotten the health care bill through, and he managed to zing John McCain on that and Mitch McConnell on that as well. So it's personal. It's what feels good to him at the moment. I don't think there's any big strategy behind these rallies other than he's putting down his marker for 2020, and he's keeping the people who put him in office energized and leading them to believe that he's getting lots done. You know, the best economy ever. The economy is actually doing well, but it's Barack Obama's economy. It's not any greater shakes than the last years of Barack Obama. And, you know, he touts clean coal coming back, and he exaggerates the small achievements he's had, and he just papers over anything that he doesn't agree with. It's a remarkable psychological world that he lives in. And, you know, people are beginning to talk, though, in fairly restrained tones about, you know, his personality quirks, to put it in the most diplomatic way, and, you know, whether the rest of government is taking, you know, proper steps to put in safeguards should we need them with this president.
A lot of people, a lot of articles have been written in just the last 24 hours, less than that, really starting to question his sanity. That has been around for a while, but there are actually serious talks, it seems like, happening now on television. Do you believe that there could be something going on there after watching him? It was just a strange speech.
Yeah, I mean, people have questioned his stability really since the campaign. And every so often he gives us more reason to wonder about it and to wonder if he is moving from the realm of, you know, personality quirk, personality disorder to something that we could really call mental illness. Yeah, I just don't think there's evidence of that at this point. I mean, I don't think he was all that different last night than he's been in other speeches that have been bizarre. My favorite part from the speech last night was when he went on about living in a bigger house and having more money and a whole segment on elites. And he's doing this on the evening after the wife of the Treasury Secretary has been castigated for putting in a post, social media post, tagging all her expensive clothes and her handbags and all that, and then getting into an exchange with someone in social media and saying rather haughtily that she and her husband have contributed a lot more to the government than this woman who had dared to contact her in a online remark. And so he just plays right into that. And you just look at this 7 months in, and the high energy, almost manic energy that he devotes across a range of causes. I mean, if he devoted all of his energy to getting one thing done, maybe he would have some success. But all of this chaotic energy, and there's just a persistent feeling here in Washington that there's no way he's gonna last a full term. But when I think about what the exit strategy is, the most plausible I can come up with is him finally, you know, throwing up his hands and saying, I don't need this. I'm going to go back to the beautiful life I had before. You know, you all figure out the debt ceiling and health care and Afghan strategy, and, you know, I've had enough. I guess that's the most plausible theory in my mind. But this is not a man who his whole being is devoted to winning and succeeding, and so that I think that would be very difficult for him to arrive at that point, and it might only arrive at that point if the special counsel actually does come up with something that seems actionable or that threatens to affect his family in a legal way. So you know, I think that's where we are. That's where we are now.
There are some points in the speech I wanted to bring up. He did mention, and he made sure to say, I'm not going to say any names tonight, but he was mainly talking about John McCain and the one health care vote. And he just kept saying, one vote, one vote, one vote. Is it wise to be talking about an elder in your own party who's battling brain cancer in the state he lives in? Was that, that seemed a little rough.
Well, the apparently 2,000 people in that arena, they loved it. They started to chant, McCain must go. But that does not play well in Washington among either Republicans or Democrats. I mean, John McCain is a war hero, and he's been a public servant for many decades. You don't have to always agree with him to, you know, respect what he's given to this country. No, that was a really low moment for President Trump to do that.
Another moment, which we're not sure where, well, I think we know what it means, but will it happen, is the pardoning of Sheriff Joe Arpaio out there, who has been convicted, 85 years old. He said Sheriff Joe didn't have anything to worry about, but he wasn't going to do anything last night. Do you think he will pardon him?
It sure sounds like he will. I don't think the sheriff really needs a pardon. I would doubt. I think, did he get something like 6 months in jail? And I kind of doubt that will ever happen. But I think that would be Trump's way of saying that he doesn't think Arpaio did anything wrong, as he said last night, that he was just doing his job. But that's, you know, he's now built that up. He's hinted at it now for several days. He hinted at it very strongly last night. If he doesn't deliver, I would think some in his base will notice. So I think he may well follow through on that. It doesn't mean a whole lot. I mean, it's not as though Arpaio was going to, you know, go to his death spending the rest of his years in jail. I mean, again, I doubt that he even would spend one night in jail. But for Trump's followers, this is a symbolic measure, and it ranks up there now with the building of the wall, or maybe it's instead of building the wall. You know, if he did that, it would buy him some time with his base. But it's an incendiary thing to do, and it's really, I think, if you in the broad sense, it's an abuse of power. Now, whether that would constitute a legal abuse of power, president can pardon whoever he wants, but I think it would be seen as this president really overstepping his power for partisan purposes.
Now, a lot of the reason for last night's speech and kind of where he went right off the bat was back to Virginia. He went to race and he read all of his statements, kind of picking and choosing what he wanted to read. But do you buy that Donald Trump is a racist? Because that seemed to be what the crowd outside was inferring. How do you think he handled that, and do you think he is that?
You know, it's hard to determine what's in someone's heart, but if you look over the course of his lifetime in Queens and in Manhattan, probably if you go back far enough to Queens and his father, they certainly had some racist policies in the real estate business, and I'm sure Donald Trump, like his father, held some pretty stereotypical views of African Americans and other minorities. But by the time he gets to Manhattan and he's moving in all those circles, you know, racism is not part of the profile of movers and shakers in Manhattan. And so I don't think he would identify himself with any of these groups. But in politics, he is not above using language in ways that motivates people who hold these beliefs. And you just have to look at the way he used the birther issue against Barack Obama. You know, why would anybody undertake that as a mission if they weren't a racist? And, you know, I don't believe Trump is a racist, but he knows how to use those issues to motivate in politics. And I think that's what he's doing now as well.
Where is the country heading with that? Because it's tough in some places. People are planning more rallies. The opposition's there. Is this going to come to a head?
Well, the Republican Party has flirted with racism for a long time. Ronald Reagan launched his 1980 campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was where three civil rights workers had been murdered. He gave a speech on states' rights, which was basically, it's what we call the dog whistle politics. I think Trump has taken all those decades of dog whistle politics, the Nixon Southern strategy and all the rest of it, and it's taken it all out in the open with a big bugle horn, and he's declaring himself basically on the side of, you know, let a thousand weeds bloom. I think most politicians are careful about this stuff because they don't want it to get out of hand. I think Trump wouldn't mind if it got out of hand, because then if it did result in more clashes like we saw in Charlottesville, and more violent clashes, and now you have the militant left is getting into the action, and if that happened, Trump could then say, oh, I need to crack down further. I mean, it would be every authoritarian's dream to have, riots in the streets that he could then quell and give himself more powers. So I think he, unlike previous presidents who have indulged in this kind of rhetoric and flirted with it, I think Trump wouldn't mind if it really did get out of hand, because then, remember, during the campaign, he said, I alone can fix it. I think that would feed into his megalomania about, running the country. And he likes the police, he likes the military, and cracking down is probably something he would love to do.
Between North Korea, the Russian investigation, looking into his finances, speeches like last night, the race issue, all of these things, do you think he'll be there? Do you think he'll make it through the end of the year?
Well, there was one report that said Robert Mueller, the special counsel, would have everything wrapped up by Thanksgiving. Now, that's been disputed to some extent, that would seem a rather rapid pace for that. So by end of the year, it would be nice to think there could be some sort of resolution and we would know how to handle this president. I kind of like David Letterman's idea. He's returning to late night television, and he said, couldn't President Trump just sign some papers and say it was a nice experiment and it didn't work? But it's not that easy. So I'm reluctant to say by the end of the year, put a timeline on it. But it's hard to see that any human being can go at the pace that he's been going, not only in terms of his personal energy, but the events and the traumas that he puts the country through, from the palace intrigue in his White House to staring down Kim Jong-un to suggesting maybe nuclear war might be in the offing, to the unleashing a level of hate that we haven't seen in this country for some time, publicly anyway. It's hard to see that can continue for 4 years.
So do you think it's highly unlikely that he'll complete his first term?
I guess, yeah, I think I would put myself in that category. But you know, again, I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know what the exit ramp is, and I think that's what we're all waiting to see.
With 12 minutes left, I want to touch on the other big story of the day. This morning on Morning Joe, Hillary Clinton's new book, What Happened, will be out September the 12th, and they had some audio excerpts from the book that were released exclusively to them, and one I found kind of interesting. It says, in the past, this is in Hillary Clinton's voice, in the past, for reasons I try to explain, I've often felt I had to be careful in public, like I was up on a wire without a net. This is in the introduction. Now I'm letting my guard down. How do you explain that, Eleanor?
Well, it's that old nothing left to lose. I mean, she's gone for the top job in the country twice and failed. I don't think this is the third time in the offing. And so she's not up on that high wire, not wanting to do anything wrong, because she's planning for the next race. And for much of her life, it wasn't only her own races, it was her husband's. And that she didn't want to interfere with his political prospects. So I also think it's the demands of book writing today that her publisher, I'm sure, pushed her, that she couldn't just take the safe route and repeat many of the things that she's repeated over the years, that she needed to give more this time. And it sounds like she's delivering.
Some of the things she delivered on in the book, she said her skin crawled at the second presidential debate as Donald Trump loomed over her. And she actually goes on to say that he was a creep. What is this creep doing behind me? And she said some of the things during the campaign baffled her. That's pretty, I just can't imagine that coming out of Hillary Clinton's mouth, but it's interesting.
Right. Well, in that debate, when she was talking and he kind of left his podium, I guess, and came up round behind her, was reminiscent of when she ran for the Senate the first time in New York in 2000, and Rick Lazio crossed the stage with a paper having to do with campaign finance reform that he wanted, was demanding that she sign. And she kept her cool, and she just kind of stared him down. And that was seen as a pivotal moment that switched the momentum in the race from Lazio to Clinton, and she won, I think, by 12 points. I'm sure that she was probably, as he was walking around, she was thinking the same thing, that she should just stay put. But in this book excerpt, she says she thought at the time maybe she should turn around and confront him and say, you know, what are you doing here? What, you know, get out of my get out of my space. And she's now looking back and wondering if she had done that, if there might have been a different dynamic in the race where she might have won. In other words, she played the cool, competent, unruffled Clinton that had worked for her in the past and that she had worked so hard to keep all her professional life, and it failed her in this instance, that if she had confronted him, that might have shown her to be a red-blooded human being as opposed to the automaton that so many voters seem to think she was. I think she really regrets now how she handled that.
It's interesting. At the end of that clip, she says what she's thinking about Trump. She says, I know you love to intimidate women, but you can't intimidate me, so back up, is what she was
right.
thinking to herself. You know, in your opinion, if she had done that, it would have seemed so out of place. Do you think it would have helped her?
You know, I would have, if she had done that, I think she would have gotten the criticism instead of him. But, you know, maybe we're all reading it wrong. You know, I think that's why she's saying it, because I think playing the victim worked for her in that Senate race, and letting him seem to intimidate and, yes, victimize her on that stage, I think she thought would play out at least in a neutral fashion. If she had defied him, that certainly would have been the story of the evening, and maybe it would have given the opening to really expose him, because that was after the Access video tape, and that was a huge story that many people thought would derail him. You know, if she had said something that reminded people of that, maybe it would have set a different dynamic in about Trump. I kind of doubt it, but when you lose a race so heartbreakingly as she did, I imagine you do go back and look at so many different things. If you had changed any one of them, because the race really was quite close, if you changed any one of them, would it have been different? And I think that's the moment that she's kind of focused on that gave him a green light to be a bully, and she didn't stand up to him.
And here's what I thought was the most profound quote that's been released so far. "Every day that I was candidate for president, I knew that millions of people were counting on me, and I couldn't bear the idea of letting them down. But I did," she said. "I couldn't get the job done, and I'll have to live with that for the rest of my life."
Right.
That's,
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
not a blame. That's not the blame game they say she's playing.
No. She, you know, in the end, it was on her. And, you know, Obama did everything he could. And she felt like she failed him. Because in that first phone call that evening, she called and her first words were, "I'm sorry." So, yeah. Well, now let's see how this book plays in terms coming at this time in the Trump presidency. If I think you've thought maybe there could be some groundswell for Hillary Clinton. I still don't think that will happen. But let's see if this book does generate, you know, some understanding of who she is and why she behaved like she did in that race, and some of her regrets, which are on her and not on other people.
You know, bringing that up, Eleanor, with the last, and I have speculated that, and I've said again on this program, I think she will if Trump gets impeached or resigns and the story is Russian collusion. But now, after reading this, something is very strange, because that last quote, she takes all the blame and she says, "I'll have to live with that for the rest of my life." I just don't think she wants to do that. I don't think that's the type of person Hillary Clinton is. And I also think, goes back to that Wellesley speech, the quote, in there, you know, there's just the trying again and again and again to win again what we lost before, T.S. Eliot. Mm-hmm. And I just think she's so wounded by this loss that I think she feels she has to go back and punch the bully. If the party doesn't get behind her, they don't. But this certainly makes her seem more human. And I don't understand.
Right.
I mean, I guess I get book advances and all that, and trying to explain why you lost the election. But it didn't have to be done right away. And that's a weird thing to say. I think that I let everybody down, and I'll live with that for the rest of my life. What misery that would be if you didn't try again, especially if there was collusion.
Yeah, but the thing is, she if she does decide, I don't think anybody's going to clear the field for her. They did that twice, actually. There are now so many people with their eye on 2020. Not that any of them seem to have the gravitas and the experience that you look at them and say, "Oh, you're the one." But there are probably 20 people, governors, senators, who are eyeing a 2020. So if she did get back in, I think she'd have a fight on her hands.
Well, and you know,
maybe that's good.
You're right. That's what I think. I think she doesn't want it to look like she's being given it. And I remember the Obama primary. And I kept saying this to people. I said, if Hillary Clinton had started out this primary season like she ended, debate-wise and crowd-wise and speech-wise, she would have won. But she thought it was in the bag, and
right. She
let it get away. But in the later debates, in her later speeches, I mean, I thought she was doing far better than Obama in the primary. And I think in the end, she was winning more states as it went on, which was strange
right. Because
she was trailing.
Right.
I don't think Bernie Sanders presented much of an obstacle to her in the back of her mind. And I don't think she ever got those boxing matches like Donald Trump was having every other week.
Right. And so she was up on that high wire protecting her image and not doing anything to slide off either way. And it was the country wasn't looking for somebody who was that careful.
And I also think that Bernie Sanders wants to run. He'll be 78. Joe Biden will not rule it out. He'd be 77. She'd be 73. Donald Trump would be 74. So it's a bizarre thing. I just haven't ruled it out yet. Likely, I don't know. The more I read, the more... I'm going to have to read the whole book. There's supposed to be some kind of other revelation in that book. Maybe this is the revelation, but we'll have to read the whole book and see what she says in the interviews. Because she'll do interviews, and everybody's going to ask her.
Right, exactly. So. Exactly. Yeah, we'll see how... whether she firmly shuts the door, whether she leaves it a crack open, whether she leaves it halfway open, you're right. We'll be able to tell from her demeanor. And probably her demeanor will also reflect what she senses from the public and from other Democrats.
You know, and I've never...
as to whether she would be an unwelcome guest at the party.
And I've never figured out yet, the night at the Javits Center, people were crying. I mean, I've seen elections,
right. And
the side that loses, it's not pleasant. I don't remember people weeping for Al Gore or John Kerry.
Well, Al Gore didn't end that night.
It didn't end that day. That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, her election was all wrapped up in the historical progress of women. And, this was to be the first woman elected. And so a lot of people in that Javits Center were women with their daughters, their young daughters.
And she keeps...
so there were a lot of tears shed.
And she keeps winning Most Admired Woman in these polls we see. So who knows? Who knows? Eleanor, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I always enjoy batting this stuff around. You take care, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. And that's all the time we have today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
It'd be nice if I got one, but I was up four times, so I was a bridesmaid, never a bride.
Marla, when you get a role today, you say you still do auditions. Does the money matter?
Yes, it does. Because I blew all my money. I won't say I blew it, but I owned a theater and I owned a jazz supper club, so all the money went. So now, when I get a job, I do want to be paid.
Are the residuals